Usually when we think about artificial intelligence, we picture this weightless, invisible brain living somewhere up in the cloud.
Right, like it's completely abstract.
Exactly. It feels like it's just software running on pure math,
Yeah.
But well, if you look at the landscape today, you start to realize the cloud is really just someone else's extremely heavy, power-hungry computer.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's actually a pretty dangerous illusion to think of the digital world as having no physical footprint. I mean, every single API call, every generated token, it all has a thermal cost, a silicon cost, and a very real supply chain reality.
And that reality is crashing into our daily lives faster than ever. So, welcome back to another deep dive. Today, our mission is to unpack the Tech and AI Daily Dispatch from May 23, 2026. We are cutting through the noise to look at how AI is quietly, and sometimes very loudly, reshaping everything from standard internet protocols to the actual price of the smartphone sitting in your pocket right now.
Yeah, it's touching everything.
It really is. Okay, let's unpack this because to me, this reads like a massive, unavoidable collision between abstract digital models and brutal physical economics.
And that tension is exactly what drives the entire industry right now. We're watching this simultaneous push toward infinite digital capability and, well, hard, finite physical limits. On one hand, you have the models getting more capable and these software ecosystems fighting this ruthless turf war for dominance. But beneath that, you have the tangible architecture, like the data protocols and the actual silicon that dictate who wins. You just cannot understand the software layer without understanding the foundation it's built on.
Which makes total sense. And right now, that foundation is undergoing a massive rewrite. So let's start with the data layer. There is a huge conversation happening around something called Elms.txt. Anna's archive just highlighted it, and it immediately rocketed to a 625-point signal on Hacker News.
Yeah, there was a massive spike.
Functionally, it's a convention that lets a website dictate what AI crawlers can and cannot index. And my initial thought was that this is basically putting up a highly specific no trespassing sign, or maybe an open house sign, exclusively for robots that eat books.
Well, I actually push back a bit on the new trespassing analogy, just because it implies a legal boundary, which is still incredibly murky right now. What's fascinating here is that this is a standard war happening in plain sight. It's going to dictate the exact makeup of future training sets. I mean, for decades, the internet ran on robots.txt.
Telling search engines where to go.
Exactly. That file told Google or Bing which pages they could index. But the mechanics of that value exchange made sense. Like Google indexes your site, they send you human traffic, and you monetize that traffic.
You get something out of it.
Right. But an AI crawler completely breaks that exchange. It ingests your site to train a model that provides answers directly, totally bypassing the need for the user to ever visit your site in the first place.
So you get nothing.
Nothing at all. So, Elms.txt isn't just a sign. It's an attempt to create a machine-readable syntax for semantic extraction consent.
But how does that actually work in practice? Like, if a crawler ignores robots.txt, it just gets blocked by a firewall, right? But if an AI company is scraping data, aren't they just downloading the raw HTML anyway? How does a text file physically stop them?
Well, it doesn't physically stop a bad actor. What it does is establish a verifiable standard. It allows a domain to cryptographically sign or specify exactly which subdirectories contain training-approved data, say public documentation, and which contain proprietary data.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. And if the major frontier model builders, who are, currently under massive legal scrutiny, if they agree to respect the protocol, it changes the game. It means the training data pipeline becomes something negotiated rather than just indiscriminately hoovered up.
And the downstream effect of that is just massive. If major repositories of human knowledge opt out, the AI models of 2027 will literally have blind spots intentionally placed there by human creators. We are filtering the universe of what machines are allowed to learn.
Precisely. And once you have that data, you have to actually build and run the model. Which brings us to the second foundational piece, which is the economics of intelligence.
The API pricing war. So DeepSeek just made their V4 Pro discount permanent. They have effectively cemented their position as the absolute cheapest frontier class model on the market. But here's where I struggle with this. If you are relentlessly driving the price of intelligence to the absolute floor, doesn't that risk hollowing out the model quality?
Not necessarily.
I mean, compute is expensive. Is this a race to the bottom, or is there some strategic play I'm missing, like a win for independent builders?
I wouldn't call it a race to the bottom. It's really a phase shift. High API costs create a moat. They ensure that only well-funded enterprise companies can afford to build autonomous agents or complex AI pipelines. What DeepSeek is doing by permanently locking in this aggressive pricing is they're commoditizing raw reasoning.
Okay.
They're establishing that the intelligence itself is not the premium product anymore.
Wait, if the intelligence isn't the product, what is?
The ecosystem. And this is the fundamental aha moment of the current landscape. DeepSeek is forcing the industry to justify its pricing gaps. It's a huge catalyst for adoption. If OpenAI is going to charge significantly more for API access, their model can't just be slightly better at writing Python.
Right. It has to offer something else.
Exactly. It'd have to be integrated into an ecosystem that makes the premium worth it. DeepSeek is basically saying, the reasoning engine is cheap. Good luck competing on lock-in.
That makes total sense. And it perfectly explains the absolute brawl we are seeing right now over walled gardens. If the model is a commodity, whoever owns the space where the user actually works wins.
Exactly.
And Microsoft just made a highly territorial move to ensure they own that space. They are actively canceling Claude Code licenses and pulling integrations to steer users toward their own Notepad-based AI tooling, which is a huge warning for enterprise workflows.
It is a textbook ecosystem capture strategy. If you're operating in an enterprise Windows environment, Microsoft doesn't want you calling an external Anthropic API to analyze your code or manage your files. They want that workflow happening inside their proprietary infrastructure.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Microsoft is acting like a jealous bouncer at a club, forcing everyone to use its Notepad AI. You live in our OS, you use our text editor, you buy your AI from the company store. But if builders demand the kind of transparency Anthropic is offering right now with Project Glasswing, will Microsoft's forced walled garden approach backfire?
That is the defining architectural battle of the next few years. It's control versus trust. Microsoft is betting on control. The friction of leaving their ecosystem is too high, so you'll just use their tools. Anthropic, with Project Glasswing, is betting on trust.
Okay, so explain Glasswing, because for years, large language models have just been massive black boxes.
Right.
You throw a prompt in, you get text out, and even the researchers who built the network couldn't tell you exactly which weights fired to generate that specific sentence. How does Glasswing actually change that?
Well, they're using something called sparse autoencoders.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, a neural network's internal state is just a giant string of numbers activations. It's completely unreadable to a human.
Just a wall of math.
Exactly. What Anthropic has done with Glasswing is build a secondary model that translates those dense, unreadable numbers into discrete features.
Mm.
They've successfully isolated the specific neural pathways that fire when the model is thinking about, say, Python syntax errors, or malicious code, or even abstract concepts like deception.
Wow.
Yeah, they're literally mapping the brain of the AI.
So they aren't just looking at the output, they are hosting the internal thought process layer by layer. Why is that specific capability so crucial for a developer right now?
Because of how we're deploying these models. 2 years ago, we used AI as a chatbot. If it hallucinated a fact in a summary email, it was annoying, but the blast radius was basically zero.
Yeah, you just delete the email.
Exactly. But today, we're using frameworks like OpenClaw, which literally hooks the AI into the operating system. The AI is reading your file system, it's executing bash scripts, it's altering code bases.
I see. If an autonomous agent has root access to your machine, a probabilistic hallucination isn't just an annoyance, it's a catastrophic system failure.
Exactly. For enterprise tools and autonomous pipelines to actually function reliably, we need auditable predictability. You cannot build a deterministic pipeline on top of a probabilistic engine unless you can audit its reasoning.
So you can actually set up safety checks.
Yes. Glasswing promises a future where a developer can programmatically say, halt this autonomous execution if the deception or malicious code feature vector spikes in the model's internal state.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot get that from a closed integration in Microsoft Notepad.
Which perfectly illustrates why the companies building these models are throwing billions of dollars at compute power. They need to run the massive base model, and then they need even more compute to run the sparse autoencoders just to map the base model.
It's a massive drain on resources.
And this arms race has a voracious appetite that is severely impacting the physical world. Let's talk about the hardware tax. We are currently looking at a global RAM shortage that is straight up killing the cheap smartphone market.
This is where we circle back to those physical limits we talked about. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the real world tax of the AI hardware race. The data centers required to train and run interpretability research on models like Claude or to power the massive volume of DeepSeek's low-cost API calls, they require staggering amounts of high bandwidth memory, or HBM.
Right. And my initial thought was to picture AI as this giant industrial vacuum cleaner just sucking up all the memory chips in the world, leaving nothing for the everyday consumer. But it's actually a supply chain allocation issue, isn't it?
It is. It helps to think of global silicon fabrication plans like TSMC or Samsung as an airport with a strictly limited number of runways. A silicon wafer is a finite piece of real estate. Right now, the AI industry is flying massive, highly profitable jumbo jets. They are demanding specialized HBM3E chips for their GPUs.
And the foundries want that money.
Exactly. Because those chips command an astronomical premium, the foundries are reallocating their fabrication lines to produce them.
Which means they are physically replacing the manufacturing lines that used to print LPDDR memory, which is the cheap, low-power RAM used in budget smartphones.
Yes. The foundries are giving all the runway slots to the AI companies. So the budget electronics sector, you know, the budget airlines, they're suddenly grounded. They're forced to bid on a shrinking supply of older memory standards.
That is just incredible. The causality is so stark. A tech giant in California decides they need 100,000 more GPUs to map the neural pathways of a language model. And as a direct consequence, the cost of manufacturing a basic sub-$200 smartphone in Brazil spikes to the point where the device is just no longer economically viable.
It's brutal.
The AI boom lands directly in your pocket, even if you never use an AI tool in your life.
It proves that compute is now a macroeconomic resource. It's no different from oil or steel. When the world's largest companies hoard it, downstream consumer markets starve.
Well, despite the severity of those hardware shortages and the corporate drama over ecosystems, independent developers are still getting their hands on these models and building phenomenal things.
Oh, absolutely.
They're taking this raw reasoning power and creating autonomous tools that cross the barrier from software to physical design. Let's look at Kanbots. This is an open source desktop Kanban app highlighted in the Dispatch. But it doesn't just manage your to-do list. It uses a multi-agent per-task approach, spinning up parallel agents for every single card to actually execute the tasks on your board.
This is a perfect example of how developers are mitigating that probabilistic nature of AI without needing full model interpretability yet. They're doing it through architectural patterns.
I have to admit, when I first read about Kanbots, letting a swarm of AI agents loose on my to-do list sounded like a recipe for absolute chaos. How does this multi-agent open claw pattern actually stay on the rails?
Well, it avoids chaos by using a directed acyclic graph, basically a rigid state machine, to govern the agents. In early AI experiments, people would just give one massive prompt to a single model and say, write a program, test it, and deploy it.
And it would just fail instantly.
Inevitably, the model would lose context and hallucinate. But Kanbots changes the paradigm. It uses a supervisor worker architecture.
So it spins up microagents with highly constrained privileges.
Exactly. It's a shift from AI that merely describes things to AI that builds things. When you drop a card into the in-progress column, Kanbots doesn't just wake up one giant brain. It spins up a researcher agent whose only tool is web search. The researcher passes a JSON file to a coder agent whose only tool is a constrained execution environment.
Okay, I see.
Then the coder passes its output to a reviewer agent. If the reviewer detects an error, it doesn't try to fix it. It just kicks it back to the coder. The LLM is just the reasoning engine powering the nodes, but the overarching logic is strictly governed by traditional deterministic code.
It's essentially simulating a hyper-specialized, incredibly fast corporate department for every single sticky note on your board. That is wild.
It's the future of workflow execution.
And the fact that this is shipping as a functional, open-source desktop app proves that the open ecosystem is thriving. But AI isn't just executing digital administrative tasks. It is writing the literal blueprints for the physical world. Let's talk about anti-gravity 2.0.
Yeah, this is perhaps the most significant technical milestone in the entire Dispatch. Anti-gravity 2.0 is a specialized model that is currently topping the OpenSCAD LLM benchmark.
And for anyone who might not live in the CAD world, OpenSCAD is a software environment for creating solid 3D models. But unlike traditional CAD, where you use a mouse to draw shapes, in OpenSCAD, you write code to generate the 3D geometry.
It's programmatic architecture.
Right. But how does a language model, which is fundamentally just a text prediction engine, perform complex spatial reasoning? It doesn't have eyes. It can't see the 3D space it's building.
That is exactly why anti-gravity 2.0 is such a breakthrough. Generalized models like your standard ChatGPT or Claude, they fail miserably at this. If you ask them to generate a 3D printable mechanical gear with specific tolerances, they'll write code that looks correct structurally, but the math will be completely wrong.
Because they're just predicting syntax.
Right. But Anti-Gravity 2.0 was trained exclusively on geometric relationships and programmatic constraints. It learned to translate the language of spatial reasoning into mathematical coordinates. It doesn't see a gear. It understands the parametric relationships required to mathematically define a gear that compiles perfectly.
It bridges the gap between a text prompt and a physical 3D printable object. You describe a structural bracket with specific dimensions, and the AI generates the code to manufacture it.
And it proves that specialized, domain-specific models will beat generalized models in the physical sciences. When you need to construct real-world architecture, you don't need a model that can write a poem. You need a model that fundamentally understands geometry.
Okay, so let's pause and look at where we are. We have AI agents capable of autonomously executing our complex software workflows with CAN bots, and we have specialized models writing our 3D architectural code with Anti-Gravity 2.0. It forces you to look at the tools of the past and ask a critical question about the future. What exactly happens to human expertise?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Josh Comeau wrote this deeply reasoned piece pushing back on the narrative that AI is going to replace developers. He argues that AI acts as a force multiplier on deep technical skill, not a substitute for it. So what does this all mean? To me, it feels like we've invented a high-powered, autonomous electric saw.
Okay, I like that.
It can cut 1,000 boards a minute, but having a fast saw doesn't make you a master carpenter. If you don't know how to calculate a load-bearing wall or measure twice and cut once, you're just going to build a collapsing house 1,000 times faster.
This raises an important question regarding that whole replacement narrative. And the Dispatch actually highlights a beautiful historical parallel today that illustrates Comeau's point perfectly. They noted the passing of Clive Moeller. He was the mathematician who created MATLAB and co-founded MathWorks.
Oh, MATLAB is practically the bedrock of modern engineering. He quietly shaped how an entire generation of engineers computed.
He really did. But think about what MATLAB actually was when Moeller created it. Before MATLAB, if you wanted to do complex linear algebra, you had to write tedious low-level Fortran code. It took days. Moeller built an abstraction layer. He allowed engineers to solve massive mathematical problems with a few keystrokes.
Right.
But here is the critical part. MATLAB did not remove the need to understand mathematics. If you didn't understand linear algebra, MATLAB was completely useless to you. It was a tool that required deep expertise to use, allowing experts to do more faster.
And we're seeing that exact same abstraction cycle happen again today. The Dispatch also mentions the release of Dano 2.8, which is slowly grinding toward production viability and narrowing the gap with Node.js.
Yeah.
It heavily abstracts the complex C++ bindings and quirks that developers used to have to manage manually. It removes the friction, but if you don't understand asynchronous event loops, Dano 2.8 won't magically make your application scalable.
Exactly. I mean, the parallels is exact. Whether it's Clive Moeller abstracting manual calculus, Dino abstracting runtime bindings, or Anti-Gravity abstracting OpenSCAD syntax, AI is just the next generation of those tools.
It removes the tedious generation part.
Right. But knowing what to build, why to build it, and how to verify that the machine did it correctly, that human mastery becomes vastly more valuable than ever. Magic is dangerous in engineering. If you treat the tool like magic, you are a liability.
What a fantastic way to frame it. The human mastery is what guides the tool. So let's bring this all together. Today, we've taken a massive journey through the modern tech stack. We started at the bedrock with Elms.txt, watching the industry try to filter the raw data that machines are allowed to learn.
And we saw the corporate turf wars, with DeepSeek driving the cost of intelligence down, forcing Microsoft into this walled garden approach, while Anthropic tries to open the black box with Glasswing.
We tracked the physical fallout of that race, connecting the demand for AI memory chips to the RAM shortages that are pricing basic smartphones out of the market.
And we explored how developers are building the future with CAN bots and Anti-Gravity, proving the enduring value of human expertise.
All while remembering pioneers like Clive Moeller. But before we go, I know you had a final thought on all this.
I do, yeah. I want to leave you with a lingering question to ponder. We've established that AI is a force multiplier for experts. But as tools like CANBOTS autonomously execute our daily entry-level coding tasks and models write our boilerplate geometries, how does the next generation actually learn?
Oh, wow.
If the junior developer never has to write the tedious code, How do they ever develop the deep expertise required to audit the AI's complex outputs? Are we building an automated society that relies on a shrinking pool of deep technical experts to understand how it all actually works? What happens in a decade if the AI is the only one who remembers the foundational knowledge we stopped bothering to learn?
Man, if we automate the struggle of learning, we might accidentally automate away the experts. That is a profound question to chew on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the tools you use, keep pushing for transparency, and most importantly, keep learning the foundations of the technology shaping your world. We'll see you next time.